guilty across his face.
So let me ask you about, so we have a single slide, and reading the closing argument, it's referenced sort of towards the end of closing argument. What is the test now after Glassman and Hecht? Is it multiple slides? Is it repetition? What's the test for whether or not this kind of argument would be reversible error, particularly on collateral attack?
Right. Well, the test is whether there's a single improper slide that is so prejudicial that it constitutes flagrant and ill-intentioned argument. In Hecht, which was a direct appeal, there was a single slide very similar to this. The first line of Hecht is essentially that the use of a slide that superimposes the word guilty over a defendant's face is improper, ill-intentioned argument. There were, as the court's question implies, multiple slides in Mr. Glassman's case, some of which spoke to his credibility, phrases like, do you believe him, why should you believe anything he says, but then there was also a slide that had picture of his booking photo with guilty superimposed three times in that case. But Hecht makes it very clear that the use of a single slide can be improper and is reversible error. I think it's also important to point out that in both Hecht and in Glassman there was no objection at trial, so the failure to object still allows the court to reach the error. But then let's get to the issue of how the court measures the prejudice. And I think what's really significant is the dissent in Glassman, where the court wants to go through. Glassman was convicted of multiple counts, two of which Mr. Glassman's attorney conceded, one of which the dissent said was overwhelming proof of guilt. And the majority opinions in that case said you don't measure prejudice by going back and reweighing the evidence. What you ask is whether the misconduct was flagrant and ill-intentioned and could have contributed to the conviction. And so in Glassman, the court said even though the evidence is overwhelming and essentially guilt was conceded, there still is a likelihood, a reasonable likelihood, that this very improper slide contributed to the verdict.
How do we do that here when Mr. McCaig was acquitted of the more serious charge, the robbery charge, and found guilty of the assault?
It's much simpler in this case because, again, going back to Glassman, there was another count in Glassman, an assault count, where Mr. Glassman was charged with first-degree assault, convicted of second-degree assault, had argued that he was guilty of a lesser degree of assault. And even the dissent, split decision, said on that one, the proof of prejudice is clear. So this is exactly like Glassman in the sense that he was charged with a more serious crime. The question was he guilty of a lesser degree of assault? If you go back to the direct appeal, the Court of Appeals opinion is a split decision. One judge said that there was insufficient proof to convict on assault in the second degree, and the Supreme Court took that issue and said it was sufficient, but obviously said it was a close call. So if you then add the prejudice together with the fact that it was a close call, it's very easy to determine that Mr. McCaig was prejudiced as a result of this highly inflammatory rhetorical device, essentially.
Isn't there an opinion by Division II where they have a similar issue and they kind of conclude not as bad as Glassman? Is it Walker, C versus Walker?
There may be. I'm not aware of any published decision that says it's not as bad as Glassman.
I don't mean to cite an unpublished one. I thought it had been published.
I could certainly stand corrected on that. But Hecht is the most recent opinion from this court, and that's the use of very similar to this, of one slide that has guilty superimposed. I want to go back to the court's earlier question because I think the court also made an important fact. It's near the end of closing. This is sort of the lasting impression that's going to be given. Lawyers know that primacy and recency are critical rules, so you put your most important stuff at first and at the end. So, if there's a bright line rule now in Washington that says this is improper, and it applies in both PRPs as it did in Glassman and direct appeal, given the close case on this assault, it seems the prejudice is obvious. Unless there are any questions, there are a number of other, I believe, meritorious issues in this case.
I want to ask you about the shackling issue. This is, again, a collateral attack. What evidence in the record is there that the jury saw the shackles?
Well, the evidence is in the post-conviction record because we can supplement. And Mr. Glassman says, although it was under his pants, it was really easy to see because you could see the outline of the device. And that at least creates a sufficient factual dispute to conduct a hearing. Now, I'm going to ask this court to reverse and not reach that issue because I think the court can do so simply on the Glassman issue. But there's a secondary argument, which is that it's not when you're talking about a shock device, a device that is both about security but about psychological threat. What we talk about there is not so much whether the jury saw it, but whether it affected the defendant's ability to fully participate in his trial.
But what do we make of the fact that the court inquires three different times and neither he nor his counsel speak up?
Well, I think what you can, first of all, conclude is that his counsel was ineffective in failing to object. Secondly, you conclude that possibly that that was the result of the device, that he didn't want to argue with the court when somebody had a button that they could push and send a shock through him that would force him to defecate in court. What we have in the record, and which should be tested if the court were not to reverse on the Glassman issue, but the court should remand for an evidentiary hearing to decide that issue, to decide whether what Mr. Glassman says in his supporting declaration is true and credible.
But he did speak up in court, so it wasn't that he was afraid to say something. He told the court that the reason that he understood from corrections that he was wearing it. So you're...
He didn't have any, yeah, here's the bottom line. He didn't have any choice in this. Corrections told him, you better be on your best behavior in court. We're going to put this device on you that will shock you. And he said, I'm not going to be a problem. That's correct. That's probably a good thing to say if somebody controls you in that particular way.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the respondent.
Good morning. My name is Carol Laverne. I represent the state. And I disagree that the test for what is reversible error regarding the closing argument is a single prejudicial slide. Really, we only have Glassman and Hecht with any speaking with any authority on this issue, and neither one of those says that. In Hecht, as a matter of fact, what the court said was the significance of this slide in isolation is debatable. And in both Glassman and Heckman, the result was reached on a cumulative effect of both that one slide and other slides. In Glassman, it was much more egregious than in Hecht, but in Glassman, they had five slides with this altered bookkeeping photo, which I presumably was never admitted into evidence. One can gather that from the tenor of the opinion. And with editorial comments on it, such as, do you believe him? Why should you believe anything he says? And then there are three succeeding slides, each with an additional guilty at a different angle, so that you end up with kind of a red asterisk in the word guilty over his face. And what the court said was, considering the entire record and circumstances of this case, there is a substantial likelihood that this misconduct affected the jury verdict. And in Hecht, you have a lesser number of objectionable incidents from the closing argument. But in that case, the prosecution used the driver's license photo, which, again, presumably was never admitted into evidence. And the court made some impact about the fact that the word guilty was on a diagonal as opposed to straight across. And then there were also multiple editorial comments in that case, such as, if he's not truthful about the little things, why should you believe him about the big things? You shouldn't, things like that. And both of these cases say that the use of graphics and the use of a PowerPoint presentation is not prohibited. All the state is required to do is not to use it in a prejudicial way. So, and McCaig's trial, of course, occurred before the Glassman case was decided, and until that time, I don't believe it occurred to anybody that the using the word guilty was either considered a personal opinion of the prosecutor or was the equivalent of shouting guilty.
I'm just curious where it came from. I mean, it seems like there have been a number of cases out of Pierce and Thurston County where this technique has been employed. I'm just curious, is it a local idea that generated this particular technique or strategy, or is it, did it come from outside, somebody that promoted this?
I have no personal knowledge whatsoever. I understand that somebody in Pierce County was at one time teaching that as a technique. They were offering classes on how to do closing arguments. And apparently Thurston County picked it up. It was before I came to Thurston County, and it had been used only by two or three prosecutors, but used extensively.
The slide where it says guilty.
Yes.
Is that an implication that it's the prosecuting attorney's opinion that he's guilty? Or how does the court on collateral attack analyze that?
Well, I would argue that even on direct appeal, it should not be considered personal opinion. I mean, the prosecutor has been arguing there for quite some time that the defendant is guilty. That's his whole point. It certainly isn't going to be any surprise to the jury that the prosecutor is going to ask them to find the defendant guilty. And here, my train of thought just went right off the track. When I guess the bottom line would be, if we only have this one thing, I mean, we have to accept now that using the word guilty in red is misconduct. It's
and
not.
You agree that it's a color slide and that guilty is in red?
Yes, it is in red. There's no dispute about that. If that is indeed misconduct, that is the only thing in McCaig case that is misconduct. The prosecutor never used any photograph that wasn't in evidence. He did not alter a photograph in any way. He didn't put any kind of editorial comments on the slides. He did not, and you can read his argument in the transcript, he did not make any of those kinds of arguments.
This is an alteration of evidence under the Glassman case, is it not? I mean, it, as the court in Glassman says, there was no photograph introduced into evidence that was a picture of Mr. McCaig with the word guilty superimposed over his face.
That's true that there
is
that.
An alteration.
I would argue evidence. That is dicta, but it does say that in Glassman. That's true. So you have this one thing. So the court then has to say, is this one thing so prejudicial that if he had made an objection at trial, would a curative instruction have been useless? And the state's position is, of course not. If, in fact, the prosecutor had yelled, he is guilty, and the defense objected and the court instructed the jury to disregard that shout, then would that have been reversible error? I would argue not. And if that is what this constitutes, if this word guilty is
well, that is what the Supreme Court said, though. I mean, that's exactly what they said. They said this is like the prosecutor shouting, guilty, guilty, guilty. And I suppose in Glassman, too, somebody could have objected. And then
yes.
Perhaps the court wouldn't have allowed the PowerPoint, but that isn't the way the Supreme Court went at it.
But the Supreme Court also said the cumulative effect in Glassman. It did not say that any one specific item that it was pointing to would have been in itself reversible error. And, in fact, they make the comment that one of the remarks, I believe, that the prosecutor made would not by itself have been reversible error. So I'm arguing that this one word guilty, even in Glassman, if Glassman case had been this case, that the Glassman court would not have reversed. They would might have found it misconduct, but without a objection on the part of the defense, it has to be so flagrant and ill intentioned that a curative instruction would have been useless. And I'm arguing that it would not have been useless.
Can I ask you about the shackling argument. Do I correctly read your brief that you agree that there should have been a hearing?
I agree that the hearing should have been done differently. He did get a hearing. I mean, the three times the court addressed it. The court did not address
it
the Hartzog case.
It was discussed, but I don't take it to be a hearing in the sense of, all right, there's a proposal here that the defendant is going to come into court wearing a shock device, and we're now going to have a hearing on it, and I'm going to find out how much shock. I'm going to ask whether there's any restrictive alternative. I'm going to ask specifically what are the reasons why this person is considered to be dangerous enough to be subjected to this. So that would be a hearing, and
okay.
People would testify on that. I realize it was discussed, but I don't consider that to be a hearing in the sense that the shackling cases use that term. Do you agree?
Yes.
Okay. So there was error in that sense.
Yes.
So now why should that not be remanded for a reference hearing? I mean, it seems to be an extreme measure. Based on what is in the record, the only reason that I can see in the record is Mr. McCaig's own comment. They told me down in the jail that because I was facing life in prison, I had to wear this thing.
Well, the second day of trial, the second time that the court addressed it with him, it was because it had been reported to the court that he had made remarks down in the jail about causing a disturbance in the courtroom.
Yeah, we don't know what those remarks were or really who reported that or, you know, what kind of fear that concerned. And, of course, that was after he'd already started out wearing the device.
That's true. But
so
this is
is this a standard policy? Does the record reflect in Thurston County? Does everybody how widespread is this practice of subjecting people to wearing a shock belt?
Again, I cannot point to the record. I can tell you it is fairly rare, only when the charges are very serious or the defendant has a history of causing some sort of disturbance.
Do we know who controls this shock device? In other words, who is it that decides when a shock should be sent?
I can't. Again, it's not on the record. I can answer your question.
So why would it not make sense to have a reference hearing?
Well, I can tell you that we had a reference hearing in a similar case with same counsel, as a matter of fact. And years after, nobody remembers. No records were kept.
Which case is that, or is that not published?
It hasn't even been decided yet. It was a personal restraint of Pender in Division 2. And it's still waiting. Actually, Division 2 has stayed consideration of that case pending some cases that are expecting a decision in the Supreme Court.
Is that a shock belt case, too?
Yes.
I'm sorry, what was that name again?
Pender, Jerome Pender.
P-E-N-D-O-T-E-R.
Yes. But the short answer is this is a collateral attack. He has to show prejudice. Hypothetical prejudice doesn't work. He has to show actual and substantial prejudice, and he hasn't done that. All he said is somebody might have seen it, and years later he suddenly remembers that he was so frightened that he couldn't participate in his defense, but he made no mention of that at the time or on direct appeal, and my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Here's what I would ask the court to do with regard to the shock device. I would ask the court to reverse on the PowerPoint issue and remand with instructions that if the state wants to use a similar device to hold a hearing prior to the conduct of that, and that the hearing should be concerned not just with its visibility to the jury, but its psychological impact on the defendant. With regard to the superimposed guilty, the state may be correct that Glassman was about multiple instances of improper conduct, but Hecht is really about a single failure. A single slide. There is discussion about why should you believe him on the big points if he's not credible on the small points, but they say that standing alone probably doesn't merit reversal, but the main discussion then focuses on the superimposed guilty over Mr. Hecht's face.
The standard then is cumulative error of this improper argument in both cases.
Well, the court says we don't really even need to measure that in Hecht because it's clear that the guilty slide is improper and causes prejudice. And remember that in Hecht, because there was no objection, the court had to find that it was flagrant and ill-intentioned. So it had to find a higher degree of prejudice in order to reach the issue. And while the state complains on some level that it's a new rule, it's not a new rule in the sense that Glassman, which was a PRP, adopted it. And so, you know, in that case, the court found that the existing precedent justified this. The technology may be new, but the technique is improper and is uniformly condemned, and this court should reverse on those.
If the slide is the equivalent of the prosecutor shouting guilty, why isn't that curable with an instruction?
Well, because the court talks in both Glassman and Hecht about the use of the visual aids has a greater power and a greater lasting effect on jurors, and therefore it's more than just shouting guilty.
Thank you, counsel. All right. We're on to